And welcome to this month's Drinking on the Last Frontier here on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna, listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. I'm your host, Bill Howell, and as always, thanks to Recess Duty for playing us in with our theme song. Well, we've got a lot of interesting news and interviews this month, so let's jump right in with beer news. The 2025 Alaska Craft Brew and Barley Wine Festival was held at the Denina Center in Anchorage on the 31st of January and the 1st of February. In the Winter Warmer competition, Rubens Brewing of Seattle took third place with its barrel-aged stout, Maui Brewing's Black Pearl Stout took second, and the Ice Spock from Glacier Brewhouse in Anchorage took first place. In the Barley Wine category, 49th State Brewing in Anchorage took third place with its Apocalyptic Sky Trumpet. Midnight Sun Brewing took second place with its Arctic Devil Barley Wine from 2020. And Rubens Brewing of Seattle also took first place with its Three Wise Men Barrel Age Barley Wine. Congratulations to all the winning breweries. The 10th Annual Frozen River Fest took place on Saturday, February 16th at Soldotna Creek Park. Breweries were in attendance from as far away as Fairbanks, and several Anchorage-based breweries attended for the first time this year. For the third year in a row, Naptown Brewing Company took home the People's Choice Award as the most popular brewery. Hoodoo Brewing of Fairbanks has purchased a beverage dispensary license, which is the type of license needed to operate a bar selling hard liquor. According to owner Bobby Wilkin, Hoodoo has no plans to start serving spirits, but purchased the license so that they would no longer be limited to 36 ounces per person per day and would have greater flexibility in offering live entertainment to their patrons. We'll have some discussions later in this month's show about efforts by different breweries to revise their licensing for similar reasons. President Trump announced that he would be imposing 25% tariffs on steel and aluminum imported into the country, set to go into effect on March 12th, and shared that he was planning on introducing reciprocal tariffs on foreign countries that currently impose tariffs on goods from the U.S. The U.S. imports more aluminum from Canada than from any other country. Even with Canada excluded from the tariffs in 2018, there were across-the-board price increases on raw aluminum impacting the price of aluminum cans. Including Canada in tariffs on aluminum this time around will undoubtedly increase the prices of aluminum products. Both producers and consumers of craft beer have been steadily choosing cans as a packaging method. In 2023, the use of aluminum cans as a packaging method grew almost 4% by volume compared to the year prior, reaching 68.4% share by volume for the year. In early 2025 sales data, aluminum cans accounted for approximately 75% of packaged craft beer's volume and revenue. Even without retaliatory tariffs, small and independent breweries that export beer to Canada have already seen the impacts of tariffs, with some provinces canceling shipments of U.S. alcoholic beverage products or encouraging consumers to buy Canadian-made products. Canada imports 37.5% of American craft beer exports, making it the industry's largest export market. If Canada, Mexico, and other trade partners decide to retaliate, breweries could see tariffs on their exported beer. Alaskans as young as 16 will be allowed to work in restaurants, and those as young as 18 will be allowed to serve alcohol if a bill passed Monday by the Alaska Senate becomes law. Senate Bill 15, which passed on a 19-0 vote, advances to the State House for consideration. The bill is almost identical to House Bill 189, which the legislature passed last year, but Governor Mike Dunleavy vetoed. In his veto message, the governor noted that the House passed it after the midnight deadline on the last day of the session. House Bill 189 was sponsored by Representative Jesse Sumner of Wasilla, who did not seek re-election last year. Senator Kelly Merrick of Eagle River reintroduced the bill at the start of this session, and it moved quickly through the Senate, becoming the first bill the Senate passed this year. No hearings have yet been scheduled in the House. Joe Gilman, production manager and longtime employee at Kenai River Brewing Company, has stepped down from his position. He will remain in the local area and will continue to be a part of the management of Kenai Joe's Bar in Kenai. Last February, a small group of alcohol breweries and wineries filed a suit against the Alaska Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, alleging that entertainment restrictions they face put them at an unconstitutional disadvantage against bars and other establishments. Plaintiffs in the case are Zip Kombucha of Anchorage and Grace Ridge Brewing and Sweet Gale Mead Works and Cider House, both based in Homer. The lawsuit was filed by the Pacific Legal Foundation, a national law firm that is taking on the case pro bono. Regarding the case, Pacific Legal states on its website, Alaska kneecaps breweries and wineries in order to protect bars from competition, restricting them from providing entertainment, including live music, TV, games, karaoke, and contests, does nothing to advance public health, safety, or welfare. The case is currently scheduled to go to trial on July 15th of this year. The trial is expected to last 3 days. The inaugural class was inducted into the American Craft Beer Hall of Fame on Saturday, February 15th. The inductees included Fritz Maytag of Anchor Brewing, British beer writer Michael Jackson, homebrewing legend Charlie Papazian, American beer writer Fred Eckhart, Jack McAuliffe, Jane Zimmerman, and Susie Stern of the pioneer microbrewery New Albion, Ken Grossman, the founder of Sierra Nevada Brewing, Jim Cook of the Boston Beer Company, Rose, Ann, and Charles Finkel, the founders of beverage importer Merchant Duvin, and brewpub pioneer Bert Grant of Yakima, Washington. That's it for beer news. Up next, we'll have an interview with Lee Ellis, the president of Midnight Sun Brewing Company in Anchorage. This is Drinking on the Last Frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna.
Hello, KDLL listeners. KDLL is conducting a listener survey, and we'd love your feedback. Visit kdll.org or KDLL 91.9 FM on Facebook for a link to our survey. Let us know a little about you, your listening preferences, and what we can do to better meet your priorities. Thanks for listening. And thanks for telling us what we can do to be the station you want to hear.
Up next, we've got Lee Ellis, president of Midnight Sun Brewing Company in Anchorage. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us, Lee. I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little about recent developments. I was up in Anchorage for the big Barley Wine Festival, everything. And I just happened to stay at the Aviator Hotel, and as I was walking into the place, I saw a big sign out front that said, Coming Soon Brewery. And I understand you guys are involved in that, so why don't you tell everybody what's going on?
Yeah, so we partnered up with the folks there at the Aviator. It's in the coming months, the name will actually change, but for now, we'll stay the Aviator. So we actually were approached by them back in 2020 and have been helping them with this project for now, I guess, going on four, almost 5 years. It's a massive remodel and upgrade to an old and aging hotel in the downtown Anchorage area. So this is kind of our second project we've embarked on to help better redevelop the downtown area. And, we're big supporters of private investment to help grow that space. So we have helped kind of design the restaurant, design the menus for that kind of stuff. We helped design the kitchen and just kind of help them along with a lot of things that we had more expertise on than perhaps the folks who are developing this project. In the next coming months, we will actually be installing a small brewery on the first floor. It will be the first hotel with a brewery in the state of Alaska, which is pretty cool. Been done in other states, but has not yet happened up here.
So why don't you describe the brewery a little bit, and size-wise everything, and how you plan to operate it?
Going to be a little 3.5-barrel brewery. So we will be just kind of doing pilot batches and small batch stuff, which should be pretty cool because we currently have a 20-hectoliter or 17-barrel system. So, our ability to experiment way out into the wilds of the world is fairly limited because, we're always committing to 30 kegs of whatever we're doing. So this is going to give us the opportunity to try some new and inventive techniques and processes and hopefully come up with some really cool beers.
And what do you think the time frame is for having that open for business? You're going to make it by summer?
So the restaurant, bar, and the majority of the hotel should be open within the next couple of weeks. So I think when you and I stayed there, they just had rooms. They still had some other rooms ready to go, but the restaurant was under construction. But that should be ready to go April. But the brewery itself, I would like to believe it's going to be sometime in July. But as we all know, with construction, rarely does anything happen within a very specific time frame. But yeah, definitely by this summer sometime.
Well, that sounds great. I'm looking forward to seeing it open. Let's shift focus a little back to Midnight Sun and the loft and everything. So you guys finally got your new license in, correct?
That is correct. So we have a full restaurant eating place license. We can serve as much beer as we want until the wee hours, if we so choose. We can have live entertainment anytime. We're actually in process right now of getting in pint glasses, so we won't be stuck to the 12 and 6-ounce options. We can actually do full pints, which is pretty cool. We'll still do like samplers and 6-ounce pours and all that kind of stuff. So we'll actually have more options for folks to try stuff.
So one of the things I've been hoping for is more and more people can move into the restaurant eating place licenses. Have you got any plans for like doing beer dinners or anything like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we actually are putting together a beer dinner for the end of March, and that is actually going to be a fundraiser for the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers of Alaska.
Any details you want to share?
It's not going to be too crazy. But yeah, so I think tickets will be going on for that one pretty soon. So we're going to have a couple different speakers presenting on different activities in wild lands, some updates on fisheries, updates on wild game. So it'll be an educational beer dinner. So we'll talk about beer, we'll talk about wild animals, and we'll talk about the great food that we're going to have. So still developing the menu right now, but we should have something out here in the next couple of weeks.
Cool. So what have you got coming out new and exciting here in the next few weeks as far as beer goes? I know farewell to Coho Ho pretty soon.
That is true. It will be getting replaced on the shelf. The beer called November is a season. So, a little bit of an ode to this year's tragically dismal winter. So that's going to be a Imperial West Coast style IPA. And then we also did a collaboration during Beer Week with our man, Phil Farrell, from down there in Georgia, Stillfire Brewing Company. So that one is actually going to be a white stout. And that is called The Snow Went Down to Georgia. So we were having a good laugh about how Atlanta was picking up more snow than Anchorage at that time. So that one should be coming up here in the next couple of weeks. And then I'm trying to think if there's anything else. We just released Arctic Devil about 2 weeks ago. So that should be making its way on all the shelves around the state. And then after that, we got a couple other things. I think we're going to be putting a Vienna Lager in the tanks. And then we're going to be putting a fruited sour into some cans here pretty soon. So we actually have quite a bit of stuff going on because it's kind of a little bit of a slower time for core brand production. So we're going to be making all sorts of fun stuff for the next couple of weeks. It'll be coming out in March and April.
Speaking of cans, have you seen any price increases yet thanks to aluminum tariffs?
There will be price increases. We got kind of hammered on that back in the late 2010s. And, we saw cans supply get strained through COVID, and then we all had to pay a significant premium. Kind of rough. You know, I think a lot of breweries tried really hard to keep pricing down. And I think especially up here in Alaska, because people are just that much more price conscious up here. And I know, you know, for my brewery and a couple other folks, it was a serious financial hit. Like I said, trying to maintain those prices and absorb those increases. I don't know if folks will be able to absorb that again. I would suspect that we will probably see prices go up at least on canned beer on the shelf and glass as well.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much inevitable that people are going to have to pass that along. It's not like anybody's got any margin to play with anymore.
And there's more stuff coming that I think, you know, the tariffs with Canada, you know, and I don't know, a lot of folks know this, but a significant amount of barley used in U.S. brewing comes from Canada. And also, you know, there's not a lot of malting facilities in North America. There's only a couple in Canada and a couple, like one or two in North Dakota. So a lot of our barley, even if it's U.S. grown, gets malted in Canada. So that's the one that we're really pretty concerned about, because if barley prices go up by 25%, that's going to have a very significant impact on what you pay at the taps, and that's across the board. So, you know, right now price increases maybe on a six pack, but if we see tariffs on European commodities and Canadian commodities, and you can expect to see price increases on across the board.
All righty. Well, anything else you want to share with our listeners, Lee? Anything else coming down the pike or anything you want to talk about?
Boy, I don't think so. I mean, it's kind of like a little bit of a quiet time right now. But yeah, go out and support your local brewer. Go out and support your local bar or restaurant. And, you know, maybe go introduce your 20-something into the amazingness of craft beer. So that's our biggest challenge right now. Younger folks, age 21 to 30, they need a spiritual guide to learn about craft beer. So go be that guide. Be that mentor.
Well,
take them out for a beer.
We're doing our part down here. We just had the Frozen River Fest, so I think we had a pretty good turnout for that. And thank you for sending some of your guys down here to support us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, hey, again, thanks for taking time to talk to us, Lee. Really appreciate it. And you have a good week, man.
Yeah, thanks. Good to talk to you.
Don't forget to tune in on Sunday nights from 7 to 9 p.m. right here on KDLL 91.9 FM to catch the show Pickled Beats, where I, your host, Josie Oliva, will be playing you a curated set of music inspired by an obscure subgenre or an oddly specific theme.
Hello and welcome back to Drink You on the Last Frontier here on KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna. Last month, I was in Anchorage for the annual meeting between the Great Northern homebrewers and the local brewing industry. As I looked around at the numerous commercial brewers in Alaska these days, it got me thinking that perhaps it would be a good time to review the history of the first brewery in Alaska to open its doors after World War II. What follows is excerpted from my book on the history of beer and brewing in our state, Alaska Beer, Liquid Gold, and the Land of the Midnight Sun. In 1974, there was another gold rush in Alaska. Or, to be more precise, there was a rush for black gold. The discovery of massive oil deposits on the North Slope necessitated the construction of the 800-mile-long Trans-Alaska Pipeline from the oil fields at Prudhoe Bay to the ice-free port of Valdez on Prince William Sound. To perform such a titanic feat of engineering, workers poured into Alaska from all over the world, creating a boom such as the state had never seen before nor since. Alcohol was one of the few distractions available, and the workers made the most of it. To this day, Alaskans still tell tales of the wild doings at bars where pipeline workers blew their large paychecks on mad benders. The governor of Alaska during much of this period was the late Jay Hammond, a revered figure among Alaskans today. However, like most such revered leaders, Hammond excited considerable criticism and opposition when he was actually in government. Reverence comes easier in retrospect. Hammond is the most famous as the architect of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, designed to convert some of the massive oil wealth the state had begun to receive after the pipeline became operational into long-term investments that would eventually generate revenue for the state. Another of Governor Hammond's ideas was to build businesses in Alaska that could sustain themselves and state revenues during the ups and downs of oil prices on the world market. One of the ideas proposed was to establish a vibrant dairy and barley business in the subarctic, supplying residents with fresh beef and dairy produced in Alaska. A report issued at Hammond's request by the University of Alaska agriculture professors supported the feasibility of the concept, allowing the governor to proclaim, "It is in fact possible that Alaska will be the prime agricultural state in the not-so-distant future." To support this vision of a developing agricultural sector, the state started a lottery to sell off 70,000 acres of land in the interior on which barley would be grown. Grain was planted and the state bought nearly $1 million worth of railroad grain cars, 20 of them painted bright blue with the words, "Alaska Agriculture Serving Alaska and the World." Then it began building an $8.5 million grain terminal in Seward. Valdez was envious, so it built an even bigger and better grain terminal that ended up costing the city upward of $30 million. There was vast optimism that Alaska would soon be producing bumper crops of barley. At this point, it occurred to someone in state government that you could do something with barley besides feeding it to dairy cows or shipping it to the lower 48. Why not use it to brew beer in Alaska? The search was on to find someone willing to invest in a brewery in Alaska to turn what was expected to be mountains of barley into cans of beer to sell to those 70,000 pipeline workers with paychecks burning holes in their pockets. After all, beer consumption statewide had gone up 16.2% even before the first section of the pipeline was buried in the ground. The Anchorage Daily News reported at the time that beer sales skyrocketed by 51% in Fairbanks, ground zero for the construction boom. With statistics like these, it did not take long for the state to find that willing investor, specifically the Radenberger Group from West Germany. Producers of such well-known brands as Radenberger Pilsner, Jever, and Schoenhofer Wiesen, the Radenberger Group created a new subsidiary to build and operate a brewery in Alaska, Prins Brau Alaska Incorporated. By the mid-1970s, Anchorage had become far and away the largest city in Alaska, so there was no question that the new brewery should be located there. The state sweetened the deal by offering Prins Brau a tax break of 56 cents per case of beer brewed in the plant being built in South Anchorage's Huffman Business Park. The brewery represented an $11.7 million investment that employed 40 locals brewing lager beers made in accordance with the Reinheitsgebot, the German purity law. Two beers were eventually produced, Prins Brau and Prins Extra, and they were packaged in both bottles and cans. Quote, "Assessing the future, Prins Brau General Manager Gerhard Konitsky sees few clouds," the Anchorage Daily News wrote at the time. "Although it will take a few years to repay the investment, Alaska beer consumption has been jumping and will probably continue to increase," end quote. Unfortunately, Konitsky's weather forecast turned out to be wrong, dead wrong. Prins Brau was out of business by 1979. So what went wrong? As is usual in the case of spectacular failures such as Prins Brau's, there were many factors that combined to bring about the disaster. First, the state's plan to grow barley was slow to get going. The first crop didn't even make it into the ground until 1978, by which point Prins Brau was already struggling. It also turned out that the strain of barley used didn't grow particularly well in Alaska due to the short summers. This was followed by a series of events right out of the Old Testament: a drought, a grasshopper infestation, and finally, roaming bison stomping through the fields. In the end, Alaska had invested $100 million in the project with nothing to show for it but empty railroad cars and useless grain terminals. So much for Hammond's vision of Alaska as a prime agricultural state. Still, while the lack of cheap and abundant locally grown barley was a disappointment, it shouldn't have scuttled Prins Brau. After all, what about all those thirsty pipeline workers? It turned out that most of those pipeline workers had been drinking some other beer somewhere else long before coming north, and they wanted to drink their beer in Alaska too. Beer companies from the lower 48 battled for a share in the small but thirsty Alaska market. Olympia Brewing went so far as to sign on as a major sponsor of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race in 1984. As a new player on the scene, Prins Brau had no brand loyalty to help it out. Plus, the brewery immediately involved itself in a labor dispute. With skilled workers in such high demand, the pipeline era was the high water mark of union power in Alaska, and Prins Brau was a non-union enterprise. The local labor leaders did everything in their power to oppose and undermine the brewery, including pickets and union-sponsored boycotts of its beer. As if its labor troubles were not enough, it seemed as though the company did everything it could to distance itself from Alaska and emphasize its Germanic roots. During its construction phase, the company held a public contest to choose the name for its flagship beer. Not surprisingly, the suggestions focused on Alaskan themes, with submissions like Grizzly Beer, King Salmon Beer, Mount McKinley Beer, and the like. After careful consideration, the managers of the brewery decided to call their flagship beer Prinzbrau. Still, the single most devastating misstep the company made was also the most simple. It sold a batch of bad beer to the public. Every brewer worth his salt knows the truth of the old saying. You only get one chance to make a first impression. If the first experience a customer has with your beer is bad, it will very likely be a long, long time before he or she gives you a second chance, if ever. Oh, and they'll probably tell 10 of their friends how lousy your beer was, too. At the time, many beer cans still had steel bodies with aluminum tops. The use of the all-aluminum can of today was growing, but was not universal. In Prinzbrau's case, the initial consignment of cans they received in Anchorage had a defective lining, allowing iron from the steel bodies to leach into the beer. Iron in beer leads to harsh and unpleasant flavors. For German lager, such as those brewed by Prinzbrau, the maximum acceptable level of iron would be less than 40 parts per million. The average level in such beers is less than 12 parts per million. In comparison, some of the cans Prinzbrau put on the market tested in a laboratory at over 200 parts per million of iron. One shudders to think just how bad it must have tasted. With such a series of missteps, Prinzbrau would have needed to produce a truly exceptional beer to overcome them. Unfortunately, what it sent to market, when it was not contaminated with iron, turned out to be little different than the beers from Olympia, Rainier, and the other breweries that were flooding into the state. Just another bland and inoffensive lager with little to offer it in way of flavor. Prinzbrau limped along until 1979, when a longshoreman strike in Seattle cut off its supplies of malted barley, forcing it to cease brewing completely. By the time the strike was settled and shipments could be resumed, the estimated cost to restart the brewery was in excess of $1 million. The investors at its German parent company declined to sink any more capital into what they now perceived as a very bad deal, so Prinzbrau closed its doors for good. And today, the only thing to show it ever existed is the occasional forgotten six-pack of Prinzbrau cans discovered when cleaning out a garage, basement, or attic in Alaska. Up next, we'll have an interview with Doug Hoag, the owner of Kenai River Brewing Company. This is KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Soldotna.
It's pick-click give time for Alaskans. When you file for the Alaska Permanent Fund dividend, you can support your favorite nonprofit organizations. Do you value public radio? Donations help KDLL provide the news, features, and entertainment programming you trust from around the world and right here at home. Apply for your dividend at pfd.alaska.gov by March 31st and pick click give to help your favorite organizations. Thanks.
Doug Hoag, the man, the legend, the owner of Kenai River Brewing Company. Doug, how are you doing this fine day, sir?
Not too bad.
Well, hey, thanks for taking the time to chat with us. So, first question, how are you doing with getting your license update? And tell everybody why you want to get a updated license.
So, it's been a very trying thing. So, I fully submitted my application in June of 2024. And when I check on it, it's been in review, essentially, which really means that it's just sitting there and nothing is being done. So I started to inquire. I don't get any response initially. So phone calls, and that goes to voicemail, and emails, and then I wait. And I did get a call. So I was kind of excited. Like 2 weeks ago, I got a phone call and they said, oh, it just moved into review. I'm like, well, it's been sitting there for a long time. But besides that, it just went to the reviewer and I should be hearing something very soon. Well, that's been 2 weeks and I haven't heard anything. So I'm not sure. Very soon is a different timeline than what I'm used to, I guess.
I guess. I was talking with Lee Ellis earlier on the show here, and it said he took 11 months to get theirs approved. So yeah. 11 months from June, that would be like May, huh?
Yeah. Which, you know, 11 months, and if we get a license, that really changes our abilities to do things. In May, we essentially won't even be looking at using that license until probably October, just because we're not going to do a big program change at the beginning of summer. So it's very unfortunate, and it's disheartening the fact that this liquor law change occurred, like 2 years ago. It took AMCO a year to figure out how they're going to implement the changes, and now they are so backlogged with doing anything that it just doesn't happen. So yeah, it's pretty disappointing.
Well, why don't you tell folks what you're asking for and why you're asking for it, what it's going to let you be able to do?
Yeah, so the big change in, I mean, it was a major rewrite of Title IV, really huge thing. Peter Michicki was pretty much the lead on this. He really pushed to get it done. It finally got passed, and then there's the rework of everything. But what it allows microbreweries to do, it's essentially a stacking of your license. So I can now be a manufacturer and a restaurant or a different kind of direct retailer. So what I can do is we run our production facility the same as we always have, where we're making beer, we're sending it to a distributor, and it gets moved around the state. The tap room, that can now turn into a legitimate restaurant, which means that we're running under the same rules as any other restaurant that you would go into. So we can serve, we'd be able to serve wine. We could do guest beers, which is kind of a fun thing, because if we get tight on some different beer in the summertime, we could bring in some beer from some other local breweries, which just continues the whole craft beer experience. And then allows us, you know, a little difference in staying open a little bit later, and some relaxation on music laws and stuff like that.
Correct me if I'm wrong, it lifts your 36 ounce daily cap, right?
It does. So the 36 ounces wouldn't be there. We would continue, you know, with obviously, you know, the monitoring of inebriation and
right.
But all of our servers and managers and everybody are tap certified. So we're always watching for that. And we're obviously a different component than like a straight bar where people are going just to do that. We're more of a community kind of social hall, I guess, to have a conversation.
And it would also let you have like some entertainment, right?
Right. Yep. Mm-hmm. It would.
So, yeah, it'll be a great day if that day ever comes, you know.
I know. So. Yeah. So it is at this point, it's kind of just a waiting game, but it is extremely frustrating. So it's not only the fact that, so in June of 2024, I submitted my application, but along with that is the full payment for that license. So since June of 2024, the state has been sitting on money for this license, which, you know, obviously I can't realize because I can't do anything different. So, yeah.
And strangely enough, they're not going to pay you any interest for all the time that they collect interest on it.
Nope,
yep.
They won't.
Yeah. So, well, let's talk about some other new stuff. Since the last time we had you on, you have some new toys in the brew house, right? Or relatively new toys. Your centrifuge and your reverse osmosis.
Yeah, we've got all kinds of new equipment that we've been kind of running over the last few years. And pretty much everything is online now, so that's is kind of exciting. We've had the centrifuge for a while. That's really helped our program. It's accelerated the way we can do some of the beer and get it a little prettier in the glass. That makes me happy. We've also moved into a pasteurization program. So as when the beer is complete, we are pasteurizing, because we just can't always ensure that the craft beer is going to be refrigerated when it leaves our facility. So it gives us a level of protection and knowing that it's still going to be a quality product, even if it's slightly mishandled by either the distributor or the consumer. So yeah, pasteurizing pretty much everything that goes out the door.
Everything you're canning and sending out the door is being pasteurized. Because I remember initially you were just doing like PBR and the half.
Yep, we've got the program set up, so we're pasteurizing everything that we do produce that's gonna leave our facility in a keg or a can. So yeah, just making sure that we keep that protection. And then the Alchemator, which is our de-alkalizing machine, that's running well. We're still toying with the NA. We always have an NA beer on tap, and that's going well. But this also, the byproduct of creating an NA beer is seltzer. So that's worked really well for us. The machine we do is it uses pressure and filtration in a kind of like reverse osmosis kind of program. So we can recirculate the original tank and then the byproduct is a seltzer, and then the other product is a NA. So that's working really well for both sides.
Two birds for the one stone. So that's a pretty good deal, though it's pretty spendy stone, as I recall.
Yeah, the capital cost of the equipment is definitely up there. So nobody gets into brewing without spending a lot of money on equipment that is all expensive because it's all stainless steel.
Yep. So have you heard any rumblings yet about your can costs going up with all this tariff talk?
Yeah. Numerous notices that I get in the email, just and it's from our suppliers, and they're, you know, obviously there's nothing that has happened yet, but that they are abreast of the situation, and just that we need to be aware that if those go into effect, then yes, there will be a somewhat dramatic price change. Yeah, it'll be a lot. If it happens, it's going to be a lot.
How about some good news? What do you got? Have you got anything interesting coming on online anytime soon, or just recently?
Actually, kind of like a big change in the whole production area for the brewery. And Joe Gilman, who's been here for 18 years, he decided he was just looking at a career change and wanted to try something different. He received the job offer at a local firm here, and he decided to go ahead and try that. So that kind of gave us a chance to kind of move into a different direction with our production supervisor, and we chose to stay in-house with who we're using, and we have Ben Wegraff, who's been here for how many years?
8 years, Bill.
Eight years now. So Ben's been with us for 8 years. He knows the production side of Kenai River Brewing Company upside and down, and so he is our new production supervisor, taking over that role. And actually, I'll let you talk to Ben because he can talk about new stuff too. But yeah, talk about what his role is going to be.
Yeah, like Doug was saying, Joe's been here for 18 years, so obviously I got some big shoes to fill. But I'm looking forward to the challenge, and we got some fun stuff coming down the line. We have a Black Forest Cake beer that I think you tried at the Frozen River Fest, yeah?
Yes, I did get some of that. It was very good.
We're looking forward to that one. We did a cherry-infused Imperial Stout. It's an 8.2 ABV, 38 IBUs. Really nice, easy drinking for an Imperial Stout. Just that fruity cherry taste. Really kind of get to those German roots in the Black Forest Cake. And we've got two more exciting things coming down the line, too. We've got a Hascap White Crane that we're looking to do. It's that the White Crane that we've had on tap for a while, one of our newer flagships. But we're using Hascap berries from Alaska Berries, local-grown Hascaps, and promoting another local business.
Yeah, oh, that's good. I love Hascaps.
I live pretty close to the winery, so it's nice to swing in and keep that relationship between the local businesses, and especially in the alcohol business. Good for everybody. We have a Helios IRPA, our Imperial Rye Pale Ale. It's really going to feature that Helios hop. An American-grown hop kind of gives that floral, herbal, spicy notes with a little bit of citrus. It's pretty well-rounded, so we're happy to kind of push that a little bit. And it's going to be a little boozier at 10.5 and 95 IBUs. But if you've had our IRPA here on tap before, it's something that we try to do every year with a different hop and experiment a little bit here in the brew house.
Sounds great, Ben. Sounds great. Well, best of luck
Thank you, Bill.
New role, man. Anything else you guys feel like the folks need to know?
No, I think we're kind of lined out. We're getting ready for pretty much full production to start moving stuff up to our distributor. And summer is starting to be upon us.
Well, hey, thanks again for taking the time to chat. Appreciate it. And you guys have a great day.
Hey, thanks, Bill.
Hello, this is Charlissa Megan, known as Truth Is. And I'm her trusty sidekick, Eva Knutson.
And we are the Sound Hunters.
Join us on Wednesday nights from 7 to 9 p.m. as we dig through our old mixtape collections and share our favorite eclectic musical finds.
That's the Sound Hunters on Wednesday nights from 7 to 9 p.m. right here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna.
Hello and welcome back to Drink on the Last Frontier. I'm your host, Bill Howell, here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna. Last month, we had Ted Rosenzweig from Turnagain Brewing on as our guest. One of the fine brews produced at Turnagain is simply called Goose. Many folks out there probably have no idea what sort of beer that is. So in this month's beer style segment, we're going to talk about one of the most unique and amazing styles of beer out there, the barrel-aged and blended style of Belgian lambic known as Goose. That's spelled G-U-E-U-Z-E, and is the French name for the style. In Belgium, they speak French in the south and Dutch in the north, and its Dutch name for this style of beer is something like Gerser. Since I grew up in New Orleans, my French is considerably better than my Dutch, so I'll stick with calling it Goose. But before we start talking about Gooses in particular, let's talk a little about lambics in general. Lambic is a sour wheat beer style brewed in and around Brussels. What makes lambic unique is the utilization of medieval or even more ancient fermentation techniques in its production, rather than the modern microbiological practices developed by Louis Pasteur and Emil Christian Hansen in the late 19th century. Lambics are produced using a complex fermentation based on locally and naturally occurring wild yeast and bacteria, which make them the prototype of so-called wild ales now being created by craft brewers all over the world. Within the family of lambics, there are several beer styles, including fruit beers such as creeks and framboise, flavored with cherries and raspberries, respectively, and faro, a lambic that has been sweetened with sugar. But today, we're interested in the most complex and highly respected of the lambic beer styles, Goose. Goose is an unfruited, sparkling form of lambic that many regard as the epitome of sour beer production. Sometimes called the Champagne of Belgium, a Goose is the blend of two or more lambics of different ages, with the younger beer providing the sugars needed for fermentation in the bottle. Goose almost certainly predates champagne and was probably originally served directly from the cask, but today it's almost exclusively a bottled beer. Producing the component lambics, which are blended to produce a Goose, is a time-intensive process. The mash of the beer is produced using 30 to 40% unmalted wheat. Rather than fresh hops, three-year-old hops are used. These hops have lost all their flavor and aroma and are used purely for their antimicrobial properties. As I mentioned, rather than adding a particular yeast strain to the wort, lambic brewers simply expose the cooling wort to the air and allow the wild yeast from the area to take hold and ferment the beer. Next, the beer is moved to wooden casks, each of which has its own complex culture of microbes residing within, and allowed to age for 1, 2, or even 3 years. Finally, lambics of different ages are mixed, bottled, and then allowed to condition. The traditional Goose flavor is dry, sharp, earthy, close to that of unblended lambic, but bottle conditioning and the resulting carbonation give it an even greater complexity and finesse. Like blending wines or Scotch whiskey, blending lambics of various ages to make a Goose is an art form. Since the base lambics have been spontaneously fermented, each barrel will have a strong individual character. Upon tasting it, the blender will have to decide whether to use the barrel now or hold it further and whether to use it for some other lambic style, such as fruited beer, or to use it for the brewery's best traditional Goose. Highly aromatic, old stinky Goose is considered quite valuable and will be used very carefully. These old lambics have barnyard aromatics reminiscent of washed Rhine cheeses, which is not surprising given that the same wild yeast and bacteria are at work in both the beer and the cheese. The goal of the blender is to produce a pleasing union of the individual lambics. The young lambics provide fermentable sugars and bright, vibrant flavors to the blend. age lambics lend complexity of flavor, along with enzymes created by the dozens of microorganisms resident in the wood of the cask. These enzymes will break down complex sugars into simple sugars that yeast and bacteria can consume to produce carbonation. The Goose blender must not only carefully manage the characteristics of taste and acidity of each different lambic, but also make sure that the beer will attain the proper high carbonation desired after bottle conditioning. The proportions of young and old lambic in a Goose differ from year to year and from one brewer to another. Some brewers use approximately 50% one-year-old, 25% two-year-old, and 25% three-year-old lambic. Others prefer two-thirds one-year-old and one-third 2 to 3-year-old. Special blends may include as little as 10% young beer. After blending, the bottle is laid down in cellars for at least 4 to 6 months of re-fermentation. Some may not be released for many years. When they are eventually served, the bottles may come to the table in a special basket to maintain the bottle in a horizontal position. This allows the yeast deposits to remain in place while the beer is poured out sparkling and clear. So how does a fine traditional Goose taste? Well, it's something close to a very dry white wine, but because of the excellent carbonation, it's effervescent and refreshing, like the finest champagne. There will be some tartness, and the more traditional the Goose, the greater the degree of tartness. There will also be many interesting so-called barnyard elements, depending on the percentage of truly old lambics used. In short, Gooses taste almost nothing like we'd expect a beer to taste. There's no hop aroma, the beer is bone dry and tart rather than malty. Some people hate them when they first taste them and then grow to love them, while others never do. Whether you love or hate the Gooses, they're a piece of living history and a strong reminder that beer is easily the most complex alcoholic beverage in the world today. If you'd like to taste a Goose, you may occasionally be able to find them from the local breweries specializing in sour beers and barrel aging, like Turnagain Brewing in Anchorage. Bottled versions from Belgium are sometimes available at Country Liquors in Kenai or the Grog Shop in Homer. The better bottle shops in Anchorage, like La Bodega or Brown Jug Warehouse, usually have some choices on offer. Don't waste your time looking for this rare beer at Safeway or Fred Meyer. If you do manage to find a bottle to try, be sure to prepare yourself for a beer style that tastes like no other. We'll be right back in a few moments with our final segment. This is Drinking on the Last Frontier, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna.
Hello, this is John Jackson, host and producer of Deeper Cuts Radio. Deeper Cuts features an artist, band, or topic. We play great music not often heard, mixing and mingling genre and era, creating a unique playlist for your listening pleasure. Tune in Fridays at 9 p.m. on KDLL 91.9 FM in beautiful Kenai, Alaska. Enjoy.
One of the things I'm frequently asked as a beer writer is, what's your favorite beer? I usually answer with the quip, the one that's in my hand right now. Plus, a real beer hunter is always hoping that the next beer they will try will be even better than the last. So no, I don't have a favorite beer. However, there is a fun mental game in this same vein that we serious beer lovers play amongst ourselves. It's called Desert Island Six Pack. The basic idea is simple. You've been shipwrecked on an island and have no prospect of ever being rescued. Luckily, the ship you were on was well stocked with beer, enough to last the rest of your life. However, there are only six different beers on the ship. What would they be? In my version, all the beers you choose must be currently commercially available, must be sold in either cans or bottles. I use those rules because the beers are supposed to have been on your ship, after all. Here's my current Desert Island six-pack. Beer number one, Saison DuPont Vieille Provigeon. This classic beer has been in my six-pack since the first time I ever heard of this game, and I can't imagine that will ever be replaced by another beer. It's the beer that established the ideal of the Belgian Saison and continues to be an exemplar of the best of that style today. As a style, Saisons are some of the most unpredictable and artisanal brews produced in Belgium. And given some of the other funky styles that nation is known for, that's really saying something. Saisons, which means season, were originally farmhouse beers brewed in March to last through the hot summer months when brewing was impossible in the days before refrigeration. As such, they had to have enough alcohol and hops to last, yet still be thirst-quenching for the farmhands who would be drinking them through the summer months. Bottled in leftover wine bottles, they would have been bottle-conditioned, with the living yeast continuing to work through the months of cellaring. This old-fashioned style of beer had almost died out in Belgium when it was discovered by the late great beer writer Michael Jackson, who almost single-handedly brought them onto the world stage. One of the six or seven Belgian breweries still producing classic saisons is the Brasserie DuPont, which is also still a working farm. Saison DuPont Vieille Provision is their flagship brew, and it's a dry, effervescent, and hoppy delight. It's incredibly refreshing and pairs exceptionally well with almost any food. Whatever I'm reduced to eating on my island, it will go down better with a Saison DuPont. Saison DuPont is now available in cans at Country Liquors in Kenai. Beer number two, Orval. Brewed by the Trappist monks of the Abbaye Notre-Dame d'Orval in Belgium, Orval is unique even in the rarefied company of Trappist ales. While most Trappist breweries make two or even three different beers, the monks at Orval produce only one. It pours a lovely golden orange color with a massive white head. Fresh, it's a wonderfully crisp and hoppy, but the true magic comes with a bit of time in the cellar. That's because the monks dose each bottle with Brettanomyces yeast, which over time consumes the residual sugars, eventually producing a tremendously dry beer laced with the semi-sour horse blanket notes that Brettanomyces is famous for. It takes about a year, but then again, I'll have plenty of time to wait on my lonely island. You can find Orval at Country Liquors as well. Beer number three, Midnight Sun Brewing's Kohoho Imperial IPA. Of course, there has to be a local IPA somewhere in my six-pack, and I agonize quite a bit about which one to include. There's so many excellent ones out there, and I rotate the ones in my beer fridge frequently, depending on what I'm in the mood for at any given time. However, in the end, I kept coming back to Kohoho Imperial IPA. This beer is one of Midnight Sun's rotating seasonals and is a more muscular version of their Sakai Red IPA. I drink an awful lot of Sakai Red and considered selecting it, but in the end decided to go for its bigger, beefier cousin. Kohoho weighs in at a hefty 8% alcohol by volume and 85 IBUs as compared to Sakai Red's 5.7% and 70, respectively. The folks at Midnight Sun achieve the increase in strength by adding fun stuff such as brown sugar, maple syrup, honey, and juniper berries. The same hops are used, Centennial, Cascade, and Simcoe, but at a more generous rate to balance the heftier grain bill. The result is an exceptional beer with a wonderful mouthfeel and a massive hop bitterness and aroma. This beer is a wonderful drink on a long, snowy evening by the fire, assuming the island I'm stranded on gets snow. Four packs of 12-count cans of Kohoho are currently available at Fred Meyer's in Soldotna, though it will be disappearing again until next winter at the end of February. Beer number four, Sierra Nevada's Bigfoot Barley Wine. My six-pack had to include a barley wine. After all, I might need to disinfect a wound or something. Like IPAs, there are a ton of wonderful barley wines out there, but Bigfoot was one of the first I ever tasted, and it remains one of the best American-style barley wines out there. Once upon a time, the early 90s, when I was living in the beer wasteland that Hawaii once was, March was one of the best times of the year. Why? Because that's when Sierra Nevada Brewing Company released their Bigfoot Barley Wine Style Ale. In our current state of beer grace, it's easy to forget what a big deal having an American-style barley wine on the shelves was then. Today, filing a barley wine on the shelf or even on tap at a local brew pub isn't very tough, but 30 years ago, Bigfoot was often the only one available. So when it hit the shelves, word would spread around and all the serious beer geeks would load up. We all bought at least a case, often two or three, which would then have to last us through the entire year. Plus, we always tried to cellar a bottle or two for a couple of years just to see how it would change. Fast forward to today. While Bigfoot might no longer be the only game in town, it's still an absolute classic American barley wine. Dosed with massive amounts of classic Northwest hops, Chinooks, Cascades, and Centennials, It charges in with 90 IBUs to balance its hefty 9.6% alcohol by volume. Whenever I open a bottle and pour it into a snifter, the hop aroma hits my nose like the perfume of a long-lost love. While I'm stuck on the island, I won't be getting the annual new release, so I'll just have to keep enjoying the single vintage and watching the flavors change as the beer matures over time. Bigfoot should be showing up on our local shelves anytime now. Beer number 5, Young Special London Ale. In picking this beer, I'm sailing dangerously close to violating my rules, as I don't think it can be found for sale in the U.S. these days. It certainly can't be found in Alaska. I know, I've tried, even going so far as to contact distributors to ask them if they could bring it in for me. Even when I lived in London, finding bottles of it wasn't exactly easy, but I think it's still available there, so technically I can choose it. Since I'm going to all this trouble to squeeze it onto the list, you might surmise that it's a very special beer for me, and you would be right. Young's London Special Ale is the name given to their cask condition export ale when bottled. This beer is one of the few true English IPAs to survive from the golden age of the mid-19th century. Bottle condition, hoppy, earthy, and strong at 6.4%. For my taste, it's the finest bottled beer Britain has ever produced, hands down. Young's was brewed at the Ram Brewery in the Wandsworth region of London. I toured it twice during my stint in London, and it was a magical place. The brewery itself was a mix of old and new with fascinating pieces of industrial archaeology, like a steam engine dating from 1835, scattered about. Unfortunately for beer lovers everywhere, Young's was a publicly owned company, so at the height of the housing bubble in Britain, the riverfront land it sat on was more valuable than the beer it produced and the history it represented. Sold off for £450 million, about $800 million at the time, the brewery closed on the 25th of September 2006. A sad end to the 430 years of brewing at the Ram Brewery. Young's is still being brewed and bottled elsewhere, so I can have it on my list even if I can't get it here in Alaska. Come to think of it, getting to drink Young's again might make being shipwrecked worth it. Beer number 6, Trake Warehouse Ale. There's the old saying that the more things change, the more they stay the same. Nothing illustrates that better than the final beer in my six-pack. I've been drinking Trake Warehouse Ale, whenever I could get it, since 1989. This is an absolutely wonderful Scotch ale from the Trake Warehouse Brewery, which is located in the oldest inhabited house in Scotland, dates back to 1107. Until the early 1900s, every large castle or manor house in Britain would have had its own brewery on the premises. The one at Trake Warehouse stood idle from sometime in the early 1800s until 1965, when it was discovered by the late Peter Maxwell Stewart, the 20th Laird of Traquair. He restarted the brewery and managed it until his death in 1990. Now it's overseen by his daughter, Catherine Maxwell Stewart. The house ale is brewed in the style of a strong Scotch ale and pours with moderate carbonation, producing a tan head that dissipates fairly quickly, but leaves a nice lacing on the glass. Its color is a very dark ruby or reddish gold, and on the palate, it's velvety smooth and very rich. You can taste a hint of the 7.2% alcohol on the tongue, as well as the slightest suggestion of peat smoke. The finish is dry, enticing you to take another sip. Given that this style has always been one of my personal favorites, I had to include one. You can usually find Trake Warehouse at Country Liquors in Kenai. There you have it, my Desert Island six-pack, at least as it stands today. That's one of the great things about your six-pack. It's always subject to change if you encounter a new and better beer tomorrow. This month's beer quote is from Arthur E. Mann, war correspondent, who, like the better-known Edward R. Murrow, broadcast from London during the German Blitz in 1940. There is a unique quality about beer in that it both soothes and stimulates. In its infinite variety, from the lightest of light lagers through the noblest of bitters and stouts to the heaviest of ales, a choice can be made which will please any palate, suit any clime, fit any occasion, and blend with any dish. That's it for this month's show. Until next time, cheers.